Morning. It's good to see everyone this morning. Today we're going to begin our study of chapters 13 to 18 between today and Wednesday night is the schedule that Grant has said that we will follow. As a brief review in our study of Samuel, we're seeing Israel still not devoted fully to God. We still see them want to be like the nations around them. Let's see. As a quick review, we began 1 Samuel, meeting Samuel's parents. His mother truly wanted a child. We see the birth and childhood of Samuel. We meet Eli the priest. Then in the second chapter, we begin seeing that Eli's sinful sons are worthless. Samuel's called to be a prophet. And Eli and everyone learns what the fate of Eli's sons are going to be. In the fourth chapter, we saw the ark captured by the Philistines. Then we saw that the reward the Philistines received from capturing the ark was not what they wanted. They received too much pain and suffering from having the ark, so they wanted to return it with a guilt offering. In the eighth chapter, as I said a moment ago, the people want to be like the people in the country surrounding them, so they want a king. And you'll recall that Samuel told them there would be consequences. And then as we were in the 11th chapter and 12th chapter, we were seeing some of the battles and of Saul and Samuel's final days as judge. As we got toward the end of class on Wednesday night, we were toward the last few verses of the 12th chapter, and it's particularly interesting to note in these verses that the people ask Samuel to pray for them so that they will not die, and they state, "We have added to all our sins this evil by asking for ourselves a king." Now, just a moment ago, I asked if you remembered 1 Samuel 8, verses 10 through 22. Samuel warned the people that having a king like the nations around them would not be good. Samuel told them that they must commit to follow the Lord. He would not cease to pray for them, however. He would do his part, but they must be the ones who fear the Lord and seek him in truth and sincerity. They need to do that with all their hearts. If they fail to do that, both they and their king will be destroyed. This is certainly a lesson for us to meditate on privately in verse 24. Only fear the Lord and serve him in truth with all your heart, for consider what great things he has done for you. If you want a verse to chew on the rest of the day, work on that one. Think of all that God has done for us. Before we look at the 13th chapter, verse 1, let's recall in 1 Samuel, the 10th chapter, verse 8, Samuel instructed Saul to go to Gilgal and wait 7 days for Samuel to come and to offer burnt offerings and sacrifice offerings. It appears Samuel did not tell Saul to go directly to Gilgal. 1 Samuel called the people together at Mizpah, where Saul was publicly proclaimed as king. As the 11th chapter ends, Samuel calls the people to go to Gilgal to renew the kingdom. And in verses 14 and 15, the people made Saul king before the Lord in Gilgal. Now, as we look at chapter 13, we will again see Saul waiting for Samuel at Gilgal. So it seems to me that a standing rule must have been that for observances by Saul while Samuel is living, that in every time of major crisis or incursions of enemy or something, they would go to Gilgal and Saul was to wait 7 days to give the tribes on both sides time to arrive and Samuel time to reach Gilgal. Another thought that, not in my notes, I wanted to share with you is when Grant and I show you these maps, or you look at maps of Israel, and we see that they're traveling from here to there and so on. If you consider the size of Israel in the days that we're studying, it's about 30% the size of the Commonwealth of Kentucky. So when we look at our state, I know it's 400 and some miles from the far east to the far west, but area-wise, Israel was about 30% the size of Kentucky. So as we get to 1 Samuel, the 13th chapter, what we're going to see in the 13th chapter are some campaigns against the Philistines, and that Saul is going to offer a presumptuous sacrifice and then be rebuked by Samuel. In the 14th chapter, Jonathan is going to attack the Philistines, and Saul's going to make a very rash oath or curse. In the 15th chapter, Saul is anointed. Saul disobeys God's instructions to totally destroy the Amalekite people. Saul's confronted by Samuel over this, and he's rejected by the Lord. So in the very first verse of the chapter 13, as we see a portion of the history of Saul's reign play out, the translation of verse 1 varies between some of our favorite translations. In fact, the ancient Septuagint version, one commentator says, leaves this verse out. The best I can say to you, my understanding of this verse comes from Acts 13:21. Paul says, "Then they asked for a king. God gave them Saul, the son of Kish, a man of the tribe of Benjamin, for 40 years. So as you look at verse 1, I know that our different translations don't always say the same thing, but Paul says that Saul reigned about 40 years. So as we look at verse 2 through verse 4, we're not told how much time has passed between Samuel's instruction in 10 verse 8, which I mentioned to you a few minutes ago, and Saul going to Gilgal and waiting for Samuel to offer the burnt offerings and sacrifice peace offerings. You'll recall, again, in the 11th chapter, verse 8, Saul had assembled 330,000 men. Here we see that time has passed, and Saul has with him only about 2,000 men at Michmash, and another 1,000 men are with Jonathan at Gibeah. So some time has passed between some of these dates. It seems as we go forward, Samuel was very correct in chapter 8 when he said a king would take men to be soldiers. It looks like he's establishing a body of men that he's going to have available. Jonathan's going to attack the outpost at Gibeah, and that's going to anger the Philistines, and it's going to result in Saul calling the people to Gilgal. The people were then summoned to Saul at Gilgal. In verse 5, the Philistines assemble a huge army. They've got chariots, they've got horsemen, 30,000 chariots, 6,000 horsemen, and people like the sand which is on the seashore. Those of you that have walked on sand know that that sounds like a lot of people. Saul, by contrast, has very few. And the Israelites are scared. I think justifiably so. They're so scared that in the blueprint on the screen, the people hid themselves in caves and thickets and cliffs and cellars and pits. And some of the people even went east toward Gilgal. You know, these people are very scared, but as for Saul, he was still in Gilgal, and all the people followed him trembling. You know, you're not going to face that many men without there being an issue. In verses 8 through 14, Samuel told Saul to meet him at Gilgal back in the 10th chapter, verse 8. Third time I think I've mentioned that, where it says, "And you shall go down before me to Gilgal, and behold, I will come down to you to offer burnt offerings and sacrifice peace offerings. You shall wait 7 days until I come to you and show you what you should do." Well, now in the 13th chapter, in verse 8, Saul waited 7 days as Samuel asked. Instead of waiting a little longer, impatient Saul ordered burnt offerings and peace offerings to be prepared. He himself seemed to officiate when it says, as soon as he finished offering the burnt offering there in verses 9 and 10. We see in that we know that he wasn't a priest. He had been ordained king. And now we see Samuel coming. And Samuel's going to challenge him over this. Samuel says, knows that Saul's not authorized to make offerings. So in verse 11, Samuel arrives. And he says, "What have you done?" You know, I guess Saul wishes he hadn't gone out to meet him. Saul offers three excuses to defend his actions. We're all familiar with excuses because I imagine all of us have offered some during our lifetimes. First, he blamed his actions on the people. They were scattering and he needed to do something to boost morale. Second, he blamed Samuel, saying, "You didn't come within the appointed days." And then third, he said the Philistines were assembling at Michmash, fearing they would attack at a time when Saul had not sought God's help. Saul says, "I forced myself and offered the burnt offering." How's that for three excuses? Well, Samuel immediately responds, "You have acted foolishly. And secondly, you have not kept the commandment of the Lord your God, which he commanded you, for now the Lord would have established your kingdom over Israel forever." As you think about that, Samuel then presents some consequences. He says, "But now your kingdom shall not endure. The Lord has sought out for himself a man after his own heart, and the Lord has appointed him as ruler over his people because you have not kept what the Lord commanded you." Now then, as you think about that, Samuel says, "Saul, your dynasty, your family's rule as king is going to be short-lived because Saul did not obey God. God found a man after his own heart, and the Lord has appointed him as a ruler over the people." Wouldn't you love to hear God say, "You're a man after my own heart"? What a wonderful comment. And then in the 13th chapter, verse 15, well, first, any comments? In the 13th chapter, verse 15, we're going to see in verses 15 to 18 that Samuel leads for Gibeah, and Saul's number of men has fallen down to 600, with which he can't fight the Philistines. So Saul and Jonathan go to Gibeah, to try to defend at least some of the ground of Benjamin, I suppose, since, you know, they're from Benjamin. In the 19th through the 23rd verses, you're going to see how degraded the Israelites' ability to commit warfare has become. In verses 19 to 23, we see the men of Israel don't have any good weapons. The Israelites don't even have blacksmiths who could sharpen their farming implements. That meant they had to pay an exorbitant price to the Philistines to sharpen their tool. Also, the high prices meant that weapons weren't affordable. That's why we see in verse 22, "On the day of battle, neither sword nor spear was found in the hands of any of the people who were with Saul and Jonathan, but they were found with Saul and his son Jonathan." Only Saul and Jonathan had weapons. In the face of these handicaps, the Israelites go out to face the Philistine invaders when they move south from the pass of Michmash. In verse 14, or in chapter 14, any comments over the first 13th chapter? In chapter 14, we see good qualities of Jonathan, the man who might have been king if Saul hadn't messed up. Saul is near Gibeah with 600 men, including Ahijah wearing the ephod, that is the high priest's robes. Without telling his father, Jonathan decides to take action against the Philistines. Jonathan's a warrior. Jonathan's ready to fight. So in verses 6 to 11, Jonathan said to the young man who was carrying his armor, "Come and let us cross over to the garrison of these uncircumcised. Perhaps the Lord will work for us, for the Lord is not restrained to save by many or by few." You know, that might have been some kind of slur toward the Philistines, these uncircumcised. As we look at this, to encourage his armor bearer, Jonathan says, the enemy is uncircumcised, they're not one of us. And secondly, God is able to give a victory to a few Israelites as well as to many. Now, that's belief in God, that's confidence. In this verse 6, Jonathan says, perhaps the Lord will work for us. The armor bearer says, I'll go with you. We'll see what happens. Jonathan says, they will cross the valley. They will reveal themselves to the Philistines. And relying on God's support, Jonathan says, if the Philistines tell them to stop, we won't go anyplace. We'll stop. If instead the Philistines challenge them to come on up to where they are, because the valley is between them, and it will be an indication the Lord has given them into our hands. So when the Philistines see Jonathan and his armor bearer, they thought the Hebrews were coming out of their hiding places. And in verses 9, in verse 10, so the men of the garrison hailed Jonathan. Did I say 10? Verse 12. So the men of the garrison hailed Jonathan and his armor bearer and said, come up to us and we will tell you something. Now that kind of clued things in, didn't it? That met the criteria that Jonathan had set forth. And they when they tell Jonathan and his armor bearer to come up, together they go up. They kill 20 men. The earth trembles, and the Philistines are scared. As you see there in verse 16, trembling in the camp. The garrison and the raiders trembled. The earth quaked. Yeah, I have no doubt I would have been scared. In verse 16, as we look at this, through verse 23, now Saul's watchman in Gibeah of Benjamin looked, and behold, the multitude melted away, and they went here and there. And Saul said to the people who were with him, number now and see who has gone from us. And when they had numbered, behold, Jonathan and his armor bearer were not there. Okay. Saul's men see the Philistines leaving. Saul thinks some of his men must have attacked the Philistines. A search of the camp reveals only Jonathan and his armor bearer missing. So next, we see that Saul calls for the priest to come forward, but the increasing noise of battle convinced Saul to join in the battle. And the Hebrews who are with the Philistines are sent decide that the Philistines aren't going to prosper in this. Verse 21, now the Hebrews who were with the Philistines previously, who went up with them all around in the camp, even they turned against the Philistines. Things looked up that day for the people of Israel. And as we look at verse 22, even the Israelites who had been hiding in the hills came out and helped pursue the Philistines who fled. So the Lord, in verse 23, delivered Israel that day, and the battle spread beyond Bethaven. So God gave Israel the victory. It wasn't Saul's doing. Jonathan thought that God might help a few against many, and that's the way it turned out. Comments through verse 23. In verse 24, now the men of Israel were hard pressed on that day, for Saul had put the people under an oath, saying, cursed be the man who eats food before evening, and until I have avenged myself on my enemies. So none of the people tasted food. How many of us in this room go all day without eating? I realize there are occasions that we may skip meals, but how much energy do we have when we don't eat? As we look at this, Saul issues a rash curse which nearly turns victory into tragedy. He's so focused on not losing the advantage in the battle with the Philistines, he says to the men of Israel, "Press on, go after these people." And he put the people under an oath. "Cursed be the man who eats food before evening until I have avenged myself on my enemies." So none of the people tasted food. Notice who Saul is focused on in these verses. Saul was focused on himself more than on fighting God's battle. Perhaps he knows that the Lord had told Samuel in 1 Samuel 9:15-16 that Saul would be the man to deliver the people from the Philistines, and he focused on that statement. Regardless, he gave no thought to the needs of his soldiers, who might be strengthened by eating and be more capable of pursuing the Philistines if they had eaten. In the 25th through the 30th verses, we see the soldiers enter the forest where they found an abundance of honey. We all know that honey is good. Honey tastes sweet. And if we have sweet tooth, we like our honey. Because of Saul's oath, none ate the honey, except verse 27 says, "But Jonathan had not heard when his father put the people under oath. Therefore, he put out the end of his staff that was in his hand and dipped it in the honeycomb and put his hand to his mouth, and his eyes brightened." Jonathan saw the value of eating. Jonathan tasted the honey. The people tell him of his father's oath. Jonathan responds by observing how much energy he had after tasting a little honey. How much more if only the people had eaten freely? Jonathan goes on to say that they would have been more effective in fighting the Philistines if they had eaten freely that day. So we get to verse 31. Another result of Saul's rash curse occurs at the end of the day when the Israelites have chased the Philistines, perhaps 20 miles to the west of where the battle began. The soldiers are weak from hunger. They see sheep and oxen, and they immediately kill them and eat them with blood. In Leviticus, the 19th chapter, verse 26, it says, "You shall not eat anything with the blood, nor practice divination or soothsaying." Deuteronomy, the 12th chapter, verse 16 says, "Only you shall not eat the blood. You are to pour it out on the ground like water." The soldiers, again, are weak from hunger. No provision, though, was made for the proper drainage of blood as referenced in Leviticus 19:26 and Deuteronomy, the 12th chapter. And they thereby were violating which law? The Mosaic law, right? After realizing the people's sin, Saul has men go through the army and obtain from each one an ox and sheep to serve as a sacrifice. Regardless of the fact that Saul was ineligible to act as a priest, he says the people have acted treacherously. He has a large stone set up on which these animals are slaughtered. And this was the first altar to the Lord that Saul set up. Not good situation involving Saul. Comments. Then Saul said, "Let us go down after the Philistines by night and take spoil among them until the morning light, and let us not leave a man of them." And they said, "Do whatever seems good to you." So I lost my place. So the priest said, let us draw near to God. Saul inquired of God, shall I go down after the Philistines? Will you give them into the hand of Israel? But he did not answer him on that day. Saul said, draw near here, all of you, all you chiefs of the people, and investigate and see how this sin has happened today. For as the Lord lives, who delivers Israel? Though it is, who? Jonathan, my son, he shall surely die. But not one of the people answered him. The men have eaten. Saul decides to press the battle, attack against the Philistines, even though it's nighttime. And if any, some of you I know have been in the woods at night, and you know that it's not brilliantly lit like it is in this room right now. You can stumble very easily. But while his officers agree, the priest suggests drawing near to God, appealing to God for guidance would be best. Saul does ask God for direction, but God doesn't answer. Saul concludes, someone has sinned and prevented God from answering, and they must die, even if it's his own son. So in verses 40 to 46, since no one answers, they cast lots. As Saul asks God for the answer to be given, and the cast of lots shows who's guilty. Yeah, Jonathan is guilty. He's the guilty person. When asked, Jonathan says he did taste honey, and he prepared to die. Now, Saul had taken a solemn oath that Jonathan surely must die. We just read that. The people adamantly refused this judgment, saying Jonathan deserves credit for the victory over the Philistines. They say, as the Lord lives, not one hair of his head shall fall to the ground, for he has worked with God this day. So the people rescued Jonathan, and he did not die. Then Saul went up from pursuing the Philistines, and the Philistines went to their own place. Happily, the people took up for Jonathan, and Saul relents. He and his men go home. The Philistines withdraw to their own territory to live to fight another day, which surely they will. In verses 47 and 48, we see a brief summary of Saul's successful campaigns against Moab and Ammon to the east, Edom to the south, Zobah to the north, Philistines to the west. As we'll read in the 18th chapter, verse 7, Saul was responsible for the death of thousands. In verses 49 to 52, we see a brief summary of some of the early parts of Saul's reign. Saul, only three sons are mentioned. He also had a son named Ishbosheth, who was king over Israel after Saul's death, 2 Samuel 2, 8, and 9, contested with David for the throne for a period of time. Saul had two daughters, one of whom David married. His wife is named in verse 50 and in 1 Samuel 20, verse 30. Saul had a wife, and in 1 Samuel 20, verse 30, he calls her perverse and a rebellious woman. You know, based on Saul's behavior, maybe she was the one that was rational. That may simply, his comments that she was perverse and rebellious may simply reflect on his state of mind at the time, because we're going to see that Saul's mind has some issues. Verse 52, now the war against the Philistines was severe all the days of Saul, and when Saul saw any mighty man or any valiant man, he attached him to his staff. There was a continual warfare with the Philistines. It wasn't pleasant in that land. Any comments through 14?
It's an interesting change in Saul's character that we see from the beginning, when he was hiding behind the luggage, when Samuel came to anoint him.
Very humble.
He's head and shoulders above the rest of the Israelites, yet he's hiding
You're trying to bring out of my mind an old quote, power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. And the power that even in our own country we see that power can be a very interesting tool when used inappropriately, and it can be very helpful if used appropriately. In the 15th chapter, first, we don't know the time interval between chapters 14 and 15. As we go into chapter 15, ask yourself, what was the first nation to attack the Israelites when they left Egypt? It was Amalek. Chapter 15 is devoted completely to events surrounding Saul's war with the Amalekites. As God's anointed, Saul had an obligation to listen to what God said through his prophet Samuel. Samuel tells Saul to go and utterly destroy Amalek. The Lord has determined to punish Amalek for the obstruction they placed in front of the people of Israel at the time of the Exodus, about 1447 B.C. While four centuries roughly have passed since that time, God has not forgotten the Amalekites' actions. And very importantly, there's been no sign of repentance by the Amalekites' people and nation. So as we look at Exodus, the 17th chapter, a couple of verses, then Amalek came and fought against Israel at Rephidim. When Moses held his hand up, that Israel prevailed. And when he let his hand down, Amalek prevailed. Verse 14, then the Lord said to Moses, write this in a book as a memorial and recite it to Joshua, that I will utterly blot out the memory of Amalek from under heaven. In Deuteronomy, the 25th chapter, remember what Amalek did to you along the way when you came out from Egypt? Verse 19, therefore, you shall blot out the memory of Amalek from under heaven. You must not forget. In other words, God's serious. And Samuel has given very proper instructions to Saul when he says in verse 3 of chapter 15, now go and strike Amalek and utterly destroy all that he has, and do not spare him, but put to death both man and woman, child and infant, ox and sheep, camel and donkey. Total destruction. So, in verses 4 to 9, in response to Samuel's instruction, Saul summons the troops. He's got 230,000 men who respond, because the Kenites were old allies dating back to the Exodus. Judges 1:16, Saul tells them to leave the area. In verses 7 to 9, we see Saul and his men defeat the Amalekites. So Saul defeated the Amalekites. From Havilah as you go to Shur, which is east of Egypt, he captured Agai, the king of the Amalekites, alive, and utterly destroyed all the people with the edge of the sword. But Saul and the people spared Agag and the best of the sheep, oxen, and fatlings, and lambs, and all that was good. Was that what God ordered? Is that what we read in Exodus? Is that what we read in Deuteronomy? Is that what Samuel instructed Saul to do? No, that's not what God ordered, is it? In verses 10 through 16, God tells Samuel that Saul did not carry out God's command. The distressed Samuel prays all night. He got up early, learned Saul was in Carmel, where Saul had set up a monument for himself, and then had gone on to Gilgal. Samuel went to him. Saul greets Samuel warmly, saying he's carried out the command of the Lord, but Samuel immediately asks why he is hearing the sound of sheep and oxen. Saul presents two excuses. Remember, Saul's good with excuses, saying, first, the people spared the livestock. He blamed the people earlier also, didn't he? The people spared the livestock. And secondly, the livestock were kept for a religious sacrifice. Samuel basically commands Saul to stop making excuses. He tells Saul what God has to say about his actions. In verses 17 to 21, Samuel reminds Saul that it was God who selected him to be king. And it was God who instructed that Amalek and all that was in it, man and beast, be destroyed totally. In verse 20, then Saul said to Samuel, I did obey the voice of the Lord and went on the mission of which the Lord sent me. And they have brought back Agag, the king of Amalek, and have utterly destroyed the Amalekites. But the people took some of the spoil, sheep and oxen, the choicest of the things devoted to the destruction. Now, that's not total destruction, is it? That's not what God wants. So Samuel says, has the Lord as much delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices as in obeying the voice of the Lord? Behold, to obey is better than sacrifice, and to heed than the fat of rams. For rebellion is as the sin of divination, and insubordination is as iniquity and idolatry. Because you have rejected the word of the Lord, he has also rejected you from being king. As we look at these slides, and we read this passage, to obey is better than sacrifice, and to heed than the fat of rams. Does God expect us to obey him today? If Doug were preaching, what would he say? Nod your head yes. God takes his commandments very seriously, and we, brethren, had better do likewise. We see that Saul just made minor tweaks to what God commanded. Didn't work out so well for him, did it? In verses 24 through 31, realizing the seriousness of his sin, Saul confesses his transgression against God's commands and pleads for God to pardon his sin and for Samuel to join him in worship. In verse 26, Samuel refuses to join Saul in worship. In desperation and tears, Saul grabs Samuel's robe as Samuel turns to leave. And it tears. And Samuel tells Saul that God has torn the kingdom from Saul and has given it to another Israelite who is better than Saul is. In verse 30, Saul again acknowledges sin. He says, I have sinned, but please honor me now before the elders of my people and before Israel, and go back with me that I may worship the Lord your God. So Samuel went back following Saul, and Saul worshiped the Lord. As we look at this, all that Samuel did then was acknowledge Saul's time in office. In verse 32 through 35, as the chapter ends, Samuel says, bring me Agag, the king of the Amalekites. And Agag comes out cheerfully, thinking, he's got it made now. Everything's fallen into place. He wasn't destroyed. He's not in danger anymore. But Samuel said, as your sword has made women childless, so shall your mother be childless among women. And Samuel hewed Agag to pieces before the Lord at Gilgal. Then Samuel went to Ramah. Saul went to his house at Gibeah. Samuel did not see Saul again until the day of his death, for Samuel grieved over Saul, and the Lord regretted that he had made Saul king over Israel. What would you like to say for 13 through 15? Thank you. Class is over. We'll begin chapter 16 on